when and how to innovate matters, because innovation is hard, it's expensive, it's risk, it's error prone. And so we don't need to innovate on every axis of the business simultaneously. Instead, we need to be very judicious about the places where we innovate. And in the places where innovating doesn't really drive the business forward, it's perfectly fine to go out and find industry best practices and adopt those.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. It's not really news, but it's a letter from me to you. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Grant Goodale. He's the co-founder and CTO at Convoy. They're on an incredible growth path. They've gone from zero to a $2.75 billion valuation in just over 5 years. Grant went behind the scenes on the principles that have helped Convoy grow, how they're maintaining a startup culture at over 1,000 employees, and the way they've tackled complexity. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Grant Goodale. Hey, Grant, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
I'm really excited. You've been a little bit busy at Convoy over the last 5 years.
A few things going on, yes. A little bit of growth, a little bit of reinventing trucking.
We were just talking about some of the numbers that are out there in public, and 665 million raised, just about 1,000 employees now, $2.75 billion valuation. And is it right that it's just 5 years in?
It is 5 years as of last April. So we're actually closing in on 6 years here in a little bit.
Wow,
so we incorporated April 1st, 2015, in case you want an auspicious date to start a company. April Fool's Day is right up there.
What have you done to scale yourself in such an extreme growth environment? Because most unicorns take 8, 9, 10 years, and you guys are almost a 3x unicorn in not even six. What has that looked like for you?
I think it has involved wearing many different hats, many more than I might have expected when we started the company. There's this notion that you're the CTO, you're the CEO, you're this some title, and that's going to define you for the entirety of your company's existence. Nothing could be further from the truth. And you're a startup, an old hand at startups, that's probably as well as anybody. You do whatever's necessary. And so at various points, I've run different functions at Convoy, functions that I have less experience at than technology. And the way you scale yourself is by being humble and by learning from anybody who will teach you. And so I've spent a lot of time talking to some of the best people in the world at functions that I had no idea about before we started Convoy, trying to understand what my company needed at this particular phase of its growth, what was going to help us reach that next phase of growth, and how quickly could we get it or do it or whatever it might be.
Can you walk me through that a little bit? Like you all of a sudden are running some part of the business that you didn't expect to be running. What's an example of that? And then how do you go through that process of reaching out to other people, identifying them, and what are the kind of questions or things that you're trying to learn in that process to be able to, you know, accomplish the goal at hand?
Sure. So a great example would be, gosh, I guess it'd be 3 years ago at this point, I found myself running the sort of people organization at Convoy, such as it was very small at the time, mostly recruiting with almost no headcount directly doing HR or things of that nature. And I have never run a people organization, never done anything like that. We actually just hired Sunita Salau from formerly of Airbnb to run it for us at scale here. And I could not be more excited to have somebody better than me doing it. It was a process of reaching out to our investors, really, first and foremost. We have some of the best investors in the world, if I do say so myself, and their portfolio companies have incredibly talented people who have done most of these things, both at the scale we were at the time and the scale that we were aspiring to be within a year to 18 months. And so faced with the choice of, do I go out and try to recruit that person and bring them in and help have them help us scale, or try to do it ourselves along the way and use that as the scaling mechanism until we reach a different inflection point where we might need a different kind of help? We chose to do both. And so immediately went out and tried to hire the best sort of people leader we could, but that doesn't close the gap in the interim. And so I spent a lot of time with our fellow portfolio companies understanding, you know, what is a startup of, at the time, I think 185 people need from a people function? What are the tools we need? What are the things we can automate through, you know, third-party software so that we don't have to be spending time on them? Really just what are the things that are going to help the company scale? And so we rolled out our first applicant tracking system so that we could handle the influx of recruiting that was coming. We rolled out our first sort of automated, sort of modern payroll system through Gusto, and found ways to scale the company aggressively while still looking for that really seasoned, talented person who's going to be able to bring the strategic lens to it. What does the people leader really need to be to help the company grow, not just in terms of headcount, but in terms of capability?
In doing that and having to do that yourself, did that change the way you thought about scoping or recruiting for the ultimate executive role, or how did it change that?
Absolutely. I think there is a lot to be said for doing something for a bit before trying to hire somebody great at it. I think the biggest challenges I've seen on the hiring front have been trying to hire for a role where I have no context on what great looks like. And so I won't claim to have been great at any of the functions that I've run outside of technology, but I think a practice of doing it for a bit and understanding what the challenges are, talking to a lot of people and learning what the challenges are secondhand really helped shape our profile for what a successful people leader would be, and also how we thought about their horizon. Because the kind of person that was going to lead the company at 185 people probably wasn't the right person to lead the company at 1,000 people. They might scale into that person, absolutely, but they probably weren't the right person out of the gate, necessarily.
How do you think about when it's time to copy somebody else's playbook versus invent your own? Because it's so powerful to be able to learn from others who have been through something like what you're doing. But I imagine there's also ways where Convoy is very unique in the situations you're facing. So did you have any good heuristics or ways that you thought about, like, when do I just need to like take a playbook from somebody else who has done this versus when do we need to invent or innovate in how we do something?
It's a great question. We actually have a company value tied to this because we felt so strongly about it in our early existence. It's called innovate deliberately. And the meaning of it is not just innovate. Obviously, we need to innovate. We're a startup. We're trying to tackle a multi-billion dollar industry. But when and how to innovate matters, because innovation is hard, it's expensive, it's risk, it's error prone. And so we don't need to innovate on every axis of the business simultaneously. Instead, we need to be very judicious about the places where we innovate. And in the places where innovating doesn't really drive the business forward, it's perfectly fine to go out and find industry best practices and adopt those. And so we've generally taken the framework of, unless it's core to the business and gives us a competitive advantage, helps build our moat, helps us build a company that's differentiated in some key critical way, it's perfectly fine to go out and look for what best practices are and adopt those.
Was that a value that you and Dan set at the beginning and knew already would be important? Or is that something you had to bring into focus as you started going?
We actually resisted the temptation to set any values from the very beginning. The only value Dan and I felt strongly about at the beginning was our values need to be something that we're already doing that we want to emphasize or double down on instead of something that we aspire to be. I think we've probably all seen and been at companies where the values are aspirational. They're what some folks at Amazon call mom and apple pie, right? They think, of course, you want to be the best company ever. You want it. They don't actually help you make decisions. Instead, they wind up tacked on the refrigerator in the break room. And so we knew we didn't want refrigerator values. We wanted values that really enabled us to identify the things that made us better and bring those out in the people that joined Convoy and identify those in people who wanted to join Convoy or that we wanted to join Convoy. And so we set down the first version of the values about a year and a half in, thereabouts. I still remember we sat down with the early leadership team in a Thai restaurant on 3rd Avenue and just said, we're not getting up until we're done with this. Buckle up and grab yourself an iced tea because it's going to be a while. And we spent several hours just articulating what we thought made Convoy successful, what we thought was different about us as a team. And we ended up with a list. I think the first list was 12 values. We've revisited it almost three times. We're in the middle of revisiting again to make sure that people understand the values the same way, that they still have the same meaning and the same expressive power that we want them to. But yeah, we wanted to make sure again that they were something we're already doing.
That's a great guardrail, that it's like something you're already living, then you don't have this gap between what you wrote on the wall and the behaviors that people actually have in the organization.
Yeah, there's a cognitive dissonance that happens when the values say one thing and you're observing behavior another way. And if there's not other examples of, no, actually, that is the behavior that we want and we value and we reward, then you wind up with drift over time and challenges.
Were there any other guardrails you had on that conversation at the Thai restaurant on Third Avenue?
One of them was they had to be things that helped us make decisions. So they didn't have to be fully non-overlapping. They could, in fact, be in tension with one another. One of the things Dan and I both saw at Amazon that we valued was some of the Amazon's leadership principles do, in fact, have tension between them. Should I have bias for action or should I dive deep? And the answer is sometimes one and sometimes the other. And so you want people to be able to find the things that are right for their situation, are right for what the problem they're trying to solve or what outcome they're trying to achieve, without necessarily constraining it to all be perfectly aligned and not in tension with each other. Because sometimes it is the right thing to spend the extra time and dive deep. And sometimes it is the right thing to move when you're 80% sure and not 100%.
Do employees ever question that? Are they like, hey, this value, it's a paradox with this other one. And how do I deal with it? Does that come up in the dialogue?
It comes up pretty frequently with folks who are coming from companies where the values aren't used for decision making. And so usually people find themselves in a position where they have to make a decision and they realize those values are in tension. And they're like, I don't know if I'm supposed to dive deep or have a sense of urgency. And I'm like, which one makes sense for you at this point? And how do you think about that trade-off? Because if you can articulate what the trade-off you're making is and why, then you're in the right. And that's why we have values that are in tension, is sometimes one's right and sometimes the other's.
I love those questions of, yeah, looking at the variables and the thinking behind which one you're picking versus just there's a black and white kind of answer there.
Yeah.
How do you make it so that the values are so present in decision-making? Is there some tactic to that or system, or how does that get instilled into the way the company actually works?
Prevalence and repetition. The values are everywhere. When we were in the office, the values were in every conference room. There were literal sort of holders of sheets of the values. So if people needed a copy to take with them, they could. And the reason those ended up empty was because we used those values as the cornerstone of our performance management culture as well. People's performance is evaluated along values, not just functional outcomes. People's interviews, we're interviewing against our values. Every interviewer has a couple of values they're trying to evaluate candidates against. We also work the language and the terminology into our weekly show and tell. We work it into our product docs and hallway conversations. You hear things like, what's the no why behind that? No why being one of our values, all the time. And so it's as much about how you construct the language of the values and where you then use that language as it is about anything else. You have to make them verbable or usable in a sentence in a way that people can adopt and everybody understands in a common way. I frequently say, I think Amazon's crowning achievement may be getting 500,000, 750,000, almost 1 million people at this point to understand each one of the leadership principles to mean the same thing. Everybody understands exactly what dive deep or bias for action means at Amazon in more or less the same way. And the amount of energy and time and work that goes into making that happen is just astronomical.
You and Dan both spent time at Amazon. Were they a big role model in how you thought about this exercise at Convoy?
The values exercise? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I think certainly in my experience, I'd never seen a place where the values were so deeply ingrained into the culture and had so much positive effect in terms of guardrail and unifying principle.
Were there any other role models you look at for this kind of stuff, like culture building and defining values or others that have influenced you?
Amazon's probably the biggest from my personal experience. I know there are other companies out there that have strong values and are following them, but I think Amazon's probably the most influential in that regard for me.
So you've been doing startups for a while. You've also been at big companies, not in trucking, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit. But I'm curious, coming in, what beliefs did you have about company building and scaling that you've changed your mind about from Convoy?
Convoy is actually now the second largest company I've ever worked for, let alone started. Most of my experience is with significantly smaller companies. And I think the thing I came into Convoy with that's changed the most over time has been the expectation that there's some magical breakpoint in a company's arc or a trajectory at which it starts to feel like a gigantic company and everything's done rigidly and it doesn't feel like a startup anymore. One of the most amazing things about Convoy, for me at least, is that even 1,000 people in, the mental attitude is still, we have a big problem to solve. It's not going away unless we go and solve it. My job as an owner of the company is to look for opportunities to make us better, to find better solutions to the problems our customers have. And there's nobody out there saying that's not my job or that's not in my wheelhouse. And I think I had this notion in my head that there was some corner that we would turn at some point, and suddenly it was all TPS reports and that kind of thing. And at least so far, it hasn't happened, and we've scaled incredibly quickly.
What's been the key to maintaining that? Because that does strike me as being rare. There's all this pressure to professionalize and put in place process and optimize for the things you can measure versus just a group of people wanting to build a great product. What has been able to keep that startup spirit at, you know, 1,000 employees and the growth that you've had?
So I think there's a couple of things that have made us successful there. First and foremost, we do have process, obviously, that we did not at 200 people. We are absolutely moving into a world of much greater measurement and optimization. And we've spent a pretty large amount of engineering hours even just instrumenting things to make sure that we know what's happening. As the complexity of the business scales, those are the things that actually speed you up as opposed to slowing you down. What never happened so far, knock on wood, is that it became process for process sake, or it became about controlling my world to the exclusion of the possibility of improvement or breakthrough ideas or betterment. And I think there's a few things that have really helped there. One is we continue to enlist employees in the overall mission of the company and the betterment of the company as a whole. We want ideas from every corner of the business. We want people to be engaged in asking why we do things the way we do, why our customers' needs are what they are, and looking for creative solutions. And that's true if you're an operations specialist who's trying to understand why a customer's facility is constantly delaying our trucks, to an engineering team who's thinking hard about how do I change a shipper's behavior when they've been doing freight and freight billing and truck management the same way for the last 25 years. We do things like our annual moonshot week, where we basically pause the company for an entire week, the entire company, and say, get together with people from different parts of the business, from our sales team, from our operations team, from engineering and data science, and go out and build in a week a prototype of the thing that you think is the next step function for the business. This year's Moonshot Week, despite being virtual and having us on two coasts, had 75 different completed projects with demoable software or achievements. And some of them were incredibly ambitious in scope and moved us into whole new areas of business that we might not have considered doing before. So I think that spirit in particular and the belief that my idea can become next year's big needle-moving project more than anything really defines the startup character, the direct line between my efforts and the direction of the company.
Well, that's a super powerful idea. Like, we've all seen it go the other way where you have process for process sake and you demoralize that spirit. So it sounds like you've done a lot of things to keep that alive and well.
I kept looking at a lot of folks who leave large companies to go work at startups. There's a common refrain of wanting to see the impact of your work in a more direct and clear way. And so the longer we can work to preserve that, the more great talent will continue to seek out a place like Convoy.
So I wanted to go back to the beginning a little bit. How did you and Dan first decide you wanted to work together?
So Dan and I worked in the same group at Amazon. We worked directly together for the whole 14 months that I was there. I did not last long at Amazon. I really like startups. And Dan had prior startup experience from his time at a little startup called Wavy that had been acquired by Google a little while before. We both really enjoyed working together and knew that startups are in our blood. And so we didn't, through the lens of our common experience at Amazon, spot something and say, oh yes, we should definitely go, since we've been working on the retail website for a year together, we should definitely go start a trucking company. But we did recognize that we worked well together and that we both had the appetite to go out and do something. We both quit Amazon before we decided what we were going to do. We just knew it was going to be really interesting.
So you knew when you quit Amazon that you two wanted to work together and you were going to go do the exploration together.
Yep.
What was your then process or framework for figuring out what to do? Because like you said, it wasn't this organic bottom-up solve my own problem kind of process. It was a different one. So I'd love to hear how that went.
It was actually deeply analytical. We spent probably the better part of 2 months chasing down maybe 10 different ideas in three different verticals, only one of which was trucking. We did macro top-down research. We did ground-up research. Dan spent a pretty healthy amount of time in Soto, wandering into places and asking them how their trucking worked, for example. We contacted, I think, 100 people cold on LinkedIn and just said, hey, we have nothing to sell. Don't even have a company to sell it from. But your role is in trucking, and we'd love to understand more about how the industry works, where the pain points are, where does money get spent, and how. And really just spent the 2 months developing a mental model for how transportation worked in the industry. Convoy could have been a very different business if it turned out there was a bigger problem somewhere else in trucking to solve. It just happened that by the time we got through looking at kind of the macro level picture of $800 billion spent annually on trucking, with the bottoms up picture of a bunch of people who are working really hard to make sure goods are moving around this country, but the degree of innovation and sort of technology disruption that had happened to date was pretty low. Everybody knew there were pain points that needed to be solved, but nobody was seeing those pain points be solved by the existing players in the industry. The meeting of those two was just so obviously the biggest opportunity we could tackle. It was a foregone conclusion by the time we got to the end of the research road.
Yeah, so Dan's going around Soto talking to people. You're doing all this bottom-up research, cold outreach to hundreds of people on LinkedIn. How did you even decide trucking before you got into those activities of like, all right, we need to learn trucking since we know nothing about it? How did you select trucking?
So one thing we did gain from Amazon was an appreciation for how things like two-day Prime were materially changing the retail landscape. It's not hard, even though we weren't on the logistics side of the business, had no direct exposure to it. It's not hard to be in the retail side of Amazon's business and appreciate that two-day Prime is fundamentally changing customer behavior. People have decided that the 15 minutes to drive to the store and buy something is more work than waiting the 2 days to have Amazon deliver it to them for free. And the degree of consternation and worry that pervaded American retail boardrooms around the time we started Convoy was just, it was pervasive. It was everywhere. And so we looked at that and we said, why is Amazon so successful at their logistics? Why is this such a complicated business? We knew it was complicated, but we didn't really know the details. And so we said, okay, there's clearly something here, but let's go learn what it is.
Gotcha. So the size of the market and this, those kind of big mega trends that you were seeing from the top, when you were comparing it to other possible categories, what were the, were there any other variables that said, oh, we got to spend time in trucking versus, I don't know, healthcare? Or if you were just searching the world for big categories, space exploration and, you know, climate change, maybe some of those were on your list. But were there any variables that weighted especially highly in the kind of first cut of the world?
One of them you just touched on, actually, which is the regulatory climate or lack thereof around freight, was extremely conducive to growing a business. There was no HIPAA for freight. There was no strong regulatory guardrail. You have the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, which governs how truck drivers are able to operate to ensure safety on the road. But deregulation of freight pricing happened back in the 70s, and it really hasn't taken up a ton of regulation since. And so you had this kind of wildly pervasive, both in terms of the number of participants on either side of the marketplace, right? Like virtually every company of a reasonable size does some degree of transportation. And truck driver is the most common job self-identified in 29 states. So you've got massive populations on both sides of the marketplace. And yet there's no like deep regulatory framework that's governing this marketplace. And so that just meant the barriers to entry were substantially lower than they might have been otherwise. And the second was the technology that had been being developed, particularly in the mobile space, over the prior, call it 2 years, made the timing for the business absolutely perfect, even more perfect even than we thought in retrospect. If you think about sort of truck drivers in general, if we tried to do this business in 2013, we would have been faced with the proposition of building a custom device that a trucker could plug into the truck in order to track location and be that sensor platform, and then shipping it to every truck we wanted to do business with, not just every company, but every individual truck that was going to do a job, basically overnight in order to instrument that fleet and to get the location tracking information and enable them to participate in the marketplace. But right around 2013 was when the Galaxy, Samsung S2, and Android basically became the default phone for almost every carrier free with data plan. By the time you got to 2014, Burger King was giving away free Android phones with a meal as long as you signed up for a 2-year contract and a data plan. And so by the time 2015 rolled around, mobile penetration in the truck driver demographic was 75% plus. So we had this magnificent sensor platform in the cab that we didn't have to ship to a carrier. They already had it on them and could give us the window into their day-to-day operations to make the business work.
It's so interesting. You hear about these kind of forces converge stories, and it's so amazing that you're able to find those. So if I heard that, the tech trigger of mobile was a little bit more of a surprise that you found after going deep into the market trigger of what was happening with trucking.
Correct. Yeah, I'll have to dig up, see if I can find you the photo. I had a photo of my desk from our earliest days, like late summer 2015, with stacks of Android phones, just similar to how PayPal had stacks of Palm Pilots back in the day. And they were pre-flashed with all of the latest version of the OS and the driver version of the app or the dispatcher version of the app in order to make sure that if we needed to ship somebody a phone, we could, and it had everything set up and ready to go. And what we discovered as we started engaging with truck drivers was, oh no, they've got a phone, no problem. Primarily Android, but a surprising amount of iOS as well, because Uber had been seeding that market for a year and a half or so prior with iOS devices. And a lot of truck drivers who drove produce, highly seasonal industry, would drive Uber in the off season. And so they got a free phone out of that. So smartphone penetration in truck drivers is incredibly high.
So it sounds like a lot of things converge, and then your bottom-up research confirmed a lot. What was the case against going into this market? Either some of the cases that you and Dan were challenging yourselves with, or maybe some, you know, people you consulted early on brought up. What were some of the cases to not do this?
So there's a ton of complexity here, obviously. Like, the industry itself is not one that is developed, even the discipline of supply chain management or transportation. These aren't disciplines that have developed in a structured way through universities and degrees over the course of the last 100 years. They're in many cases very organically developed because individual companies' challenges and needs vary wildly. And so the things that work at an Anheuser-Busch, a beer distributor with, you know, timeliness and freshness constraints and distributors sitting in between the end customer and the manufacturer look very different than a construction materials company or a company that makes pipe for oil and gas exploration. And so you have this wildly fragmented, in many ways, market in terms of the process fragmentation for the shippers. The equipment that carriers have is highly fragmented. Some carriers have refrigerated truck trailers, some have non-refrigerated, some have flatbeds, some move heavy equipment. And so you had this world where we had to pick and choose the niches that we wanted to serve in order to be successful and really dial down the fragmentation as much as possible so that we could prove our early sort of proof points and value proposition. And there were a few times where we would look at that, and even customers who needed the same type of truck had some what we thought were similar types of goods, but their processes had looked totally different. Oh no, we deliver from one warehouse to 5 customers a day, not one customer point to point. Oh, okay. Well, that's very different than how we think about the world. Do we understand the marketplace enough? Is this the right product? So that complexity was at times, it could be very daunting. You think about satisfying every shipper's needs, and you think about how they manage those needs today. There, we had a running joke in the early days of Convoy that if you had $100 million in revenue or less as a shipper, you probably managed your shipping operations with Excel. And if you had over $100 million in revenue, you still used Excel, but you shared it with SharePoint. It's way more complex, obviously, but there's a lot of variance in terms of the tools shippers use. And it's a real testament to the industry that they get everything we need from point A to point B on a regular basis. Like, the logistics teams are the unsung heroes of the American economy.
How big of a hurdle did you perceive the complexity to be? Was it almost enough to dissuade you from going down this path? Or was it just, oh, here's a list of things that we're going to have to solve for as we move forward and we can tackle this?
Logically, the latter. Emotionally, occasionally the former. So there were a few points where we looked at things and went, okay, this is the first time we started talking to Unilever, our very first large enterprise customer by several orders of magnitude. The complexity of how they operated their supply chain, how they purchased freight, how they managed it was head and shoulders above anything we'd tackled before. But we took a deep breath and said, all right, they're excited to partner. We're excited to partner with them. And we figured it out.
Even knowing that it was complex, it was still surprising to see the actual complexity in practice.
Watching it play out is, it's a real study in the kinds of complexities that large scale enterprises deal with every day across whole facets of their organization. It's very rare to find complete uniformity and consistency in any business practice across an organization of sufficient scale. And so that was a huge learning for us along the way, is we need to be able to understand the intricacies of our customers' business, and in some cases, the business of our customers, well enough to be able to help our customers deliver on their customer promise.
And how do you go into that rabbit hole? Because you can go so deep in the customer's complexity of a giant enterprise, and maybe their customers are equally complex, but you're multiplying out. How did you go about tackling that, both in the early days and as you've scaled that capability?
We start small, obviously. There's no need to boil the ocean from day one. And frankly, most large organizations aren't interested in handing over huge percentages of their total freight to a brand new company, even if it's been around for a long time, at the drop of a hat. They're going to manage their risk in a similar fashion. They're going to start small and they're going to grow. And so it's really about understanding the way that our customers engage with their customers and how they manage freight, and building those competencies into our sort of understanding of how to move freight for them. So it is a far more personalized experience than you might expect from the outside. If you tend to think about moving freight the same way we think about moving people at this point via something like Uber or Lyft.
Yeah, I think it strikes me as a potentially helpful lesson for anybody that's going to sell anything to an enterprise, particularly a complex product or service like what you have. How did you get the customer comfortable with, hey, these guys building this startup are going to be able to understand our business to that level? What was the dialogue like maybe in some of those early bigger deals when you guys would show up and get them comfortable that, hey, we can map this out and solve these problems even though we don't have the domain knowledge?
We learned very quickly that our customers at the operating levels of the business understood that technology could be impactful, but not in the absence of execution performance. That usually manifested in meetings where we would explain the virtues of Convoy, why we could do a better job, and then they would say, perfect, let's go do our first 10 shipments together, and we'll come back and we'll talk about how it went and the ways in which what you do is different from how we've seen other companies do it in the past. And so that led to a lot of learnings on our side around how best to structure those pilots, those initial engagements, to maximize the amount of value we could deliver to the customer. Because at the end of the day, if you're a Unilever or a Procter & Gamble or Anheuser-Busch, a company moving 10 shipments for you doesn't move the needle for anything in particular. But if they can see the kinds of value that the data we generate from moving those 10 shipments can provide, and they can extrapolate from that into how much value they would have gotten if Convoy had done 1,000 shipments or all of the shipments from a particular facility, that's usually where the strategic partnership starts. And that's when we start to have the deeper conversations around, oh, I can take this data and I can operationalize it. What else can you give me? How else can I learn where the inefficiencies are, where the hidden costs are?
Yeah, I love that. Being able to, take a small scope or a small slice, but have a really big impact on that small part of the business and then extrapolating. That sounds like it would be, as a buyer, like a great way to build trust.
Well, and over time, the power of our digital freight network and the instrumentation that we're able to provide, not just for a single customer's jobs, but the jobs of all of the customers within the network, mean that we start to be able to build a very rich picture for these customers earlier and earlier in the engagement, because we have access to broad data around the locales they ship from, the routes they ship on, their peers within their industry, and we can start to paint pictures for them of where they stand compared to other companies like them or other facilities in their region.
You've been able to attract this celebrity list of investors, names like Mark Benioff, Jeff Bezos, Al Gore and his fund, I believe, Henry Kravis. The list goes on. Can you talk about the early conversations with investors and what do you think it was that made you so attractive to such a high profile group?
Sure. I think there are a couple of factors here. One is, and I want to give a shout out to Hadi Partovi, who was our earliest angel investor, the first investor that really believed in what we were doing. he really helped us in terms of crafting that message and helping other investors understand the huge opportunity that we were working with. So I think he was instrumental in helping us in those early days get off the ground. And I think a lot of the things that attracted those investors and convinced them had to do with both the size of the opportunity. It's rare to find more or less undisrupted $800 billion opportunities with low regulatory hurdles and incredibly invested participants in the marketplace who are actively seeking change. So it's that I think helped a lot. And then I think the other piece was, I think Dan and I had very credible startup backgrounds. They saw that we were people that were going to tackle this problem aggressively. Even by the time we were talking to seed investors, we had already developed a really compelling model of how the industry worked, where the inefficiency was, and how a startup might be able to leverage current technology, specifically mobile, in order to build out something that was highly disruptive.
Can you talk a little bit about the insights that Hadi shared that helped you tell the story or position it or make the idea digestible to other investors?
I think from our perspective, it was less about crafting the message specifically and more about pushing us to think even bigger, to really drive for that swing for the fences mentality and the really large opportunity that trucking represented. As well as, I think you pointed out just a moment ago, the breadth of expertise of the initial investor set is not accidental. We knew from the very early days that we wanted to work with large corporations. And because we're a small startup, we won't have their trust immediately. And so the notion of how do we attract a blend of technology investors and financial industry investors and leverage the two of those as trust by proxy, so that our early customers were able to say, okay, Convoy is brand new, but these investors are people that I recognize from my world, whether my world is technology or whether my world is freight. I know some of these companies, some of these investors, and I should probably give them a shot.
I'd love to click down on the how to think bigger thing a little bit more. What does that look and feel like? The difference between you were already thinking really big. What was the delta or what was the slight nuance that got you to frame it in even a bigger way in your own mind or think about it in a bigger way?
I think one of the biggest insights was the freight market very naturally breaks down into what we'll call for hire, which is the brokered or the asset-based carriers that are doing work through an intermediary, and the sort of private fleet or big fleet for companies like Pepsi who own their own trucks and they operate them. And when you put those two together, they can look very different from the outset. But I think a lot of the thinking that we did early and some of the evidence that we collected along the way really suggested that a well-run, efficient marketplace for freight could substitute for those private fleets. And so suddenly it went from there's a portion of the market that's brokered and that's the portion we could tackle to actually, no, we could substitute for a huge chunk of, if not the entirety of this $800 billion space.
That's such a powerful mindset of just asking, what if we served this other part? What if, how might we? That sounds incredible. Grant, this is such a great story. I'm so psyched to see what you guys have done in such a short time. I could talk to you for hours, but I want to wrap it up with the Supersonic Six.
All right, hit me.
Rapid fire round, as you know. So number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I've ramped down a little bit recently. I think being home and not having easy access to infinite quantities has helped. I'm still probably a 2 to 3 cup a day guy.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I absolutely love what Remitly is doing. I think the message of empowering this population through removing friction in the financial industry and enabling people who've made the choice to go abroad and work away from their families to enrich the lives of their family back home is just amazing. And so I really love what Matt and team have been able to build.
Awesome. Yeah, Matt Oppenheimer was on this podcast early on. So for listeners, check that one out if you want to learn more about Remitly. Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
I am incredibly impressed with what Andy Jassy has managed to achieve over at Amazon for AWS. If you think about sort of rocket ship rides, the growth rate and the impact that AWS has had from, oh, we're going to do storage in the cloud to I've materially reduced the cost of starting a business in the technology space by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude in some cases, it's hard to overstate. Like, it is fundamentally easier to build a technology company today than it was 10 years ago. And that is almost exclusively at the feet of both open source and AWS.
Number four, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
We need to dream bigger and we need to bet bigger. I see a lot of startups out there, which I'm excited by, and I think we're getting better at this, but I want to see more entrepreneurs take on really large, globally impactful problems. And I want to see more investors willing to make significant bets on them at early stages based out of Seattle. I think we are a fairly conservative town when it comes to both startup ideas and investing. And I'd like to see us recognize that we have the talent pool, we have the ideas, we just need to go out and be more aggressive.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
All right, I'm going to date myself with this, but I would say this whole dot-com thing is probably going to be pretty big. And so I should probably leave Southern California and move to Silicon Valley a little bit earlier. So I was
good advice, yeah.
Degree, and the dot-com bubble was starting to rise. And I instead stayed in Southern California for a couple of years. I'm maybe wishing I had to move north a little bit sooner.
That's very practical. Number six, what can this community do to help you? Is there a job post you want people to pay attention to, an event, anything you want people to go do after hearing this?
Two things. One, we have many open positions right now. We are scaling up for 2021. Please go out and check out our jobs page, offconvoy.com. We have many opportunities in technology, engineering, demand, G&A, you name it, everything we're hiring for. But the other is mask up, stay healthy. Faster we get done with COVID, the better.
Thank you for doing this, Grant. This has been awesome. I love talking with you.
It's been fun.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.